You're listening to a Zone Radio podcast, zoneradio.co.za.
The IP Zone is brought to you by Spoor & Fisher, because every pioneer needs a partner.
At Spoor & Fisher, we understand the value of innovation and the sinister threats of your ideas being stolen.
Spoor & Fisher specializes in IP law. Our experienced team of specialists will do everything to protect what's yours.
When concept becomes reality, we're there to lock it down.
Create it. Own it.
Choose Spoor & Fisher to secure your intellectual property.
And with that, we welcome Professor John McKnight into the studio. And John is a partner at the law firm Spoor & Fisher. And he's going to be speaking to us this afternoon about patents and designs. Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon, Unicorn, on this cold and bleak afternoon.
In more ways than one.
Indeed.
All right. The issue of patents and designs. This is a specialized area of law.
That's correct. So you can't actually practice patent law unless you've passed the exams, which are levied by the South African Institute of Intellectual Property Law, because it is so specialized. So if you do have an idea that you need protected or whatever, you do need to go to a specialist attorney, being a patent attorney. And you can only call yourself a patent attorney if you have passed these exams as raised by the institute. Yeah.
Okay. So it's not a good thing just to pop down to your local, you know, my sister's lawyer. Not a good idea to go to her and say, I've got an idea, you protect it.
No, yeah.
Not going to work.
No. I can't see that ending well for anybody.
Yeah. All right. So I'll hand it over to you.
Okay. Well, thanks. So, thank you for having me here again. The listeners will recall we were here a month ago when we spoke about the basic concepts of intellectual property. And one of the things we spoke about how your ideas are intellectual property, and it begins its life between somebody's ears, and that as such, that's a broad genus of aspects of law. And so intellectual property includes a number of species of law. That would be patent law, registered design law, trademark law, copyright law, and then the law of know-how or confidential secrets. And over the coming weeks, we will take deep dives into trademarks, into copyright. And today is the turn of patents and designs.
Okay.
So I will be talking about those. Next month, you'll meet one of our associates from our firm, and she will talk to us about trademarks. But being that I am a patent attorney, I feel confident to speak about them.
You may know a thing or two about this.
So you'll remember that patents protect ideas in industrially realizable form. A patent can protect a new product, a new process, or the new use of a known product. So let's start with a definition of patent. What is a patent? And really, it's an agreement between an inventor and the government of a country in which the inventor agrees to publish his or her invention, and in return, the government agrees to give the inventor exclusivity on the use of the invention for a limited time. So it's based on a quid pro quo. And the philosophy behind patent law is that a government is a functioning government is tasked with the role of lessening the burden of its citizens and solving the problems which afflict society. Now, it can't do all of that itself, so it encourages and incentivizes people to solve problems. And the deal is basically, if you solve a problem in a way that is new and not obvious, then we're all very grateful for that solution which you offer us. And in return, to thank you for offering up the solution, you can have 20 years to be the only guy to practice the solution, and you may become very wealthy because of it. So that's the idea behind a patent. I'm going to encourage you to solve problems, and when you do solve a problem, you get a monopoly on that solution. And that's what a patent is, right?
Okay,
so a patent document has to fully describe the invention for a number of reasons. First of all, it must be a complete teaching, so that somebody unrelated to the project can pick up that document and say, oh, he's done this. That's really good. That's really clever. So it must be able to be put into practice by itself. So a patent document must be a complete teaching in and of itself. Okay, that's the first thing. The second thing is, because it's a monopoly and because it's telling people what they cannot do, at least for 20 years, it's got to set it out, right? It's, so you've got to know what you're not allowed to do. And that's what patents do. They define monopolies. And that's why these patent documents, which are drafted by patent attorneys, are so important, because they are teachings so that everybody is in full possession of everything that's required to put this invention into practice. But they're also documents setting out what you're not allowed to do. So they strike this balance.
And when you say you're not allowed to do, the inventor or anybody else?
Anybody else.
Okay.
Yeah, anybody else. So it's that's an excellent question, Unicorn, because there is the inventor. Now, he's the guy who comes up with a solution, but he's not necessarily the guy who will end up owning the patent, right? So think of it of a builder who builds your house, but every builder doesn't live in every house that he owns. You pay your builder to build your house, and then you give him money, and then he builds your house and gives it to you. Well, he sold it to you. It's exactly the same with intellectual property. So there are scientists that are employed by companies to invent, and part of their deal is they get paid their salary, and in return they have to assign their patents to the company.
Okay.
And it's and even inventors who invent bras and things in their garages, if they want investors, if they need some muscle to help commercialize the idea, they have to sell all or part of the invention to their financiers. So inventors very often don't actually own the patents. And it's the owners of the patents who are the guys who get to call the shots as to who can practice that invention or not, often to the exclusion of the inventor himself. So it can be, there can be a little bit of drama there. But the inventor and the owner of a patent are more often than not two separate entities.
Not to sidetrack you, but that Vodacom you call me is a classic example of that.
Yeah. So that's where it's argued that an employee in the course and scope of his employment came up with an idea. Therefore, it must vest with the employer. And there's a lot of case law around that. That Vodacom case is highly complex. And all of us in IP are sort of scratching our heads about it, because it doesn't make a lot of sense when it comes to the broad principles. And we can discuss that in a week or two's time. But it's a very, very interesting case. But but generally, one of the more accepted cases is an individual versus the weather service. Now, this guy was employed in the weather service to be a weather forecaster, right? That was his job. In his spare time at home, in his garage, using a private PC, he wrote a program that was excellent at predicting the weather, forecasting weather. South African Weather Service says, that's ours because you made it. You might have made it in your own time, but you are employed by us to forecast the weather. So the fact that this computer program was written out of hours on your own personal equipment, but for us, you wouldn't have written it. So it's owned by us. So and that's case law in South Africa. It was found to belong to the weather service by this guy. Yeah, but by the same token, if you are employed to sweep the floors at the weather service and you come up with a program to forecast weather,
different story.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. What is a patent? Okay. Patents protect ideas or principles underlying an invention. So an invention can be a new apparatus or a machine. It can be any new product or it can be a new method or a process. So there are two terms and conditions that apply. Well, there's actually several, but the two big ones that apply before you can get patent protection are: the solution that you offer up, the invention, has to be absolutely novel. This is a very high barrier to entry, because you're talking about a 20-year monopoly, right? They're not just going to give these away. So in order to get this 20-year monopoly, you have to be the first guy to have thought of this particular solution in the history of humanity. It can never have been published or made available to the public in any form before the day on which you apply for your patent. So it's pretty hectic, okay? So a little definition here. In most countries, the invention must never have been made public in any way, for example, by oral disclosure, use, trial, printed publication, or any language anywhere in the world before the date on which an application for a patent is filed. Okay, so you think, oh, that's easy. I've just got to keep it secret. But it's really a lot more difficult than that, because if you need help with your invention, if you want to gauge interest in your invention, you can't tell anybody about it before you file for your patent application. And I can't tell you how many cases I've had over the years where inventors have shot themselves in the foot because they publicly disclosed their invention before filing for patent protection, and in so doing invalidated the patent after that because they themselves made it available to the public. That's the law in South Africa. The law in the U.S. is slightly more forgiving to U.S. citizens, not South African citizens, but so we don't have to worry about it. So we just hold ourselves to this very high standard of absolute novelty, which is here in South Africa and the U.K. and Europe and, dare I say, most civilized countries. So that's the idea. So, okay, so the first, your idea, absolutely novel. Second thing, your idea, to the extent it's novel, must be inventive. Now you think, okay, well, now what does inventive mean? So a very unhelpful definition of inventive is not obvious. Thanks for that. Okay, so an inventive step would be something, would someone with a good knowledge and experience of the subject, the person skilled in the art, think that the invention or the solution offered up by the invention was obvious when comparing it with what was already known, which is the prior art. Okay, so let me tell you, as a young, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed student of patent law, I really battled with this concept.
I'm battling with it right now.
So the easiest way to talk about it is to, let's tell a story, right? So imagine we live in a world where we only know red bicycles, okay? So every bicycle on the face of the planet is red. Nobody's thought about any other color bicycle. They're all just, bicycles are red. End of story, okay? You come along and you say, I'm going to paint my bicycle green and I'm going to get a patent for it. So you take your bicycle, which is red, and you paint it green and you apply for a patent. And you say, my patent relates to a bicycle which is green. The patent office will say, okay, they will grudgingly acknowledge novelty in this fictional world where we live in, because there has never been a publication, an idea, or anything, any suggestion of a bicycle that is not red. So you come along and you say green bicycle. So you satisfy the novelty requirement. You pass that hurdle. But the examiner will then say to you, well, it's an obvious variant of red bicycles to simply take green paint, which is known, and apply it to a red bicycle. There is nothing inventive about it. It's an obvious thing to do. That's when you come in and you say, well, actually, it is inventive because there were certain advantages that come from a green bicycle as opposed to a red bicycle. And the examiner will go, oh, yeah, tell me about it. So then you say, okay, so we did a study, and on the Isle of Wight, which has 200 bicycles, we put 200 red bicycles in, and 100 red bicycles and 100 of our new green bicycles. And after a year, we went back and we found out what's happened to them. And we found that 50% of the red bicycles were stolen, but only 10% of the green bicycles were stolen. So green bicycles get stolen less. And that's because by painting your bicycle green, you can hide it in a hedge and nobody sees it. You can leave it on the lawn and he doesn't see it. Mm. But a red bicycle stands out when you leave it on the lawn or you leave it against a tree or something. And so they get stolen more. So there is a surprising technical advantage that comes from this point of difference. The point of difference being it's painted green. So if you can hang a non-predictable technical advantage onto your point of difference, you've got inventive step.
Okay.
And that's basically it, right? So there's got to be something surprising about the solution, something non-predictable, something that you couldn't have said it's going to be better or it's going to be cheaper or it's going to take less energy to make or something. There's got to be something, an advantage that is not foreseeable. And then you've set aside inventive step.
Wow.
I hope that makes sense. And if it hasn't, then I really encourage the listeners to drop us a line to say, what are you talking about, dude?
WhatsApp number 072-447-8044. All right.
Okay. So I think just to finish off today, I would like to talk about an interesting patent case, which is the case of Polaroid versus Kodak.
Ah.
And do you remember, well, if you're as old as the unicorn and I, then you will remember those old cameras in the late 70s, which were Instamatic. So they were box-like. You pointed them, click, and then out came the photograph, and you waved it around to dry, and there you had your picture. And that was the what they called instant cameras back in the day. You didn't have to take your film to be. Okay, so the story behind the instant camera. The invention of instant cameras is credited to an American scientist called Edward Land. Okay, who unveiled the first commercial instant camera, the Land camera, in 1947.
Wow, as far back as that?
Yeah, yeah. So 10 years after founding the Polaroid Corporation. So he was the guy. Okay, so Edward Land was a bit of a saddo in that he liked to bounce around the fields of New England in America taking pictures of butterflies and flowers, and he didn't like to wait until the Wednesday after he took his roll of film into the drugstore on Monday, have to wait 3 days to get it. So for him, it was all about getting his pictures there and then. So he was a real photography enthusiast. So the Land camera, the first instant camera, was a serious piece of kit, and there was a real focus on quality of picture, because, you know, he wanted his butterflies to pop, you know, in these pictures. So it was really good. Kodak took one look at this and said, there's another way we can do this. We are going to make an instant camera, and we're going to make it cheap, and we're going to make it nasty, and we are going to make our money off the back of the film, which is the consumable. Mm. So we're going to aim our camera. We're going to basically give them away, and then people are going to be buying our film and taking happy snaps of the aunt and the dog and the family tea party, et cetera, et cetera. And we're not going to focus on all of the optics, et cetera, that the Land camera has. And that's what they did. So the Kodamatic cameras accepted only Kodak-branded film, and they were designed to maximize sale of the film. That's where the money was, in the consumable. So Edward Land, clever guy that he was, he had about 10 patents on his camera, on the Land camera. And Polaroid bought a patent infringement lawsuit against Kodak. And it took 10 years, but eventually Kodak was forced to stop manufacture of both the camera and the film. Kodak was also left to pay a settlement to some customers who were left without a way to use their now defunct cameras. Mm. So basically what Edward Land got was he got an interdict preventing further acts of infringement. He got damages, which is to say a reasonable royalty on every camera that was sold. He got delivery up of all the infringing cameras, and he got his own costs. Okay. So it just goes to show, in the judgment, the reason I talk about this case is because at the time, and even today, adjusted for money, because this was around about the end of the 70s or early 80s, the judgment was announced at $905 million.
Wow.
The following judgment, the equity value of Kodak promptly increased by $800 million, and that's because the elimination of uncertainty as to the outcome of the litigation was accompanied by an increase in Kodak's market equity value. So Kodak was found guilty of this patent infringement case, and they had all these cameras, et cetera, that they had to pay for, et cetera, et cetera. Everybody knew a big financial snort club was coming. And even though it set the record at the time, everybody was relieved when that judgment came out because they realized Kodak can survive this, right? They came back. So the judgment was composed of about half of it was lost profits and reasonable royalty damages, but the other half was interest because the original acts of infringement took place 10 years before the judgment. So they were saying, you know, any damages were payable from that date and interest accrued at that date going forward. So you know, there was a big interest component to that. So the judgment gives enormous incentive to sue rather than to settle, unfortunately. And so that's why you tend to have these rather big patent battles, which are very expensive, but there's often a lot at stake. Mm. So I'd just like to end off by saying that, unfortunately, patent law is not really designed for the man in the street. There are examples of guys who have made money with it, but I would caution inventors before they sort of remortgage their house to pay for a patent application. It's very expensive. It's very complicated. And you really need a big brother behind you. It's a very difficult journey. It's a very difficult road to walk if it's just you. So, but that I don't want to discourage anybody.
No.
But I do want to manage their expectations.
Well, at the very least, ask somebody, is this a road I should be going down, and what would it cost to go down this road?
And all patent attorneys will be very helpful in that advice. There will be no surprises. They will tell you how long it's going to take, how much it's going to cost. So you will not be blindsided by anything like that. So that's very important. So the real advice is, if you think you've got something, pick up the phone, call a patent attorney. Not necessarily me. There's lots of us out there.
Well, we want them to call Spur and Fisher.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be very, very happy to talk to anybody. And the other thing is that, of course, no surprises. So your first consultation, almost all patent attorneys will offer the first 30 minutes or so free, gratis, and for nothing, because we want you to succeed. We want to see South Africa as an innovative country. We want more creepy crawlies and Dolos and all of those amazing inventions that have come out of South Africa. We want more of those. So, yeah, talk to us. We'll make it happen if it's at all possible.
Well, if you think you were done yet, you're not. Because I have a question, and Trish has a question. She says, can John please explain the difference between a provisional patent and a patent?
Oh, yes, I can. Thank you, Trish. And this is somebody who's walked on this journey, right? So the journey for a patent, a granted patent, normally begins with a provisional application. So that's put together quite quickly because it's quite important to get your application on file so that you can begin to talk to others and share your ideas and maybe start raising finance or getting partners on board. And you can do all of that once you've got your provisional patent. A provisional patent is a stakeholder patent. It just establishes the date by which novelty and inventor step are judged, right? Mm. Because if you file your patent application on the 1st of July, any document or anything essentially describing your invention which publishes either on or after that date is ignored for the purposes of patent application because you got there first.
Okay.
So when you have an invention, it's quite important to put a lot of pressure on yourselves and your team to get a filing date as soon as possible. And you do that with a provisional application. So it's not, it's usually just the bare bones of the invention and it's just as much
as a placeholder.
It's a placeholder. Mm. And then what you've got to do is you've got to solidify or cement your rights by way of a complete application within 12 months of filing of your provisional.
Okay.
So and then it's your complete application that then goes to grant, has a claim set with it, and that's the one that you start kicking ass and taking names with down the little course. Your provisional application just put the line in the sand and held the dates for you. Yeah.
Well, there we go. That hopefully answers that question, Trish. The other thing is, while you were talking about the Kodak and the Lands case, I couldn't help thinking about disposable razors.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
At some point that was a novel idea and the whole thing, but now you can go into a pharmacy and they're all doing the same thing and they all look very similar and, you know, they've got some, they've got three blades, some they've got four, some they've got two, but they're either the blades attached well, but essentially they're the same looking type of item. So my question is, do you get to a point where the patent expires? So
yes.
Now anybody's making razors now, I'm guessing there is no...
Well, there would be no patent anymore because patents only last for 20 years, right? Oh. That's an important thing that I possibly should have mentioned earlier.
Now, you did mention it. I just missed it.
So 20 years, and then it comes off patent, and then anybody can use it. But now you start talking about protecting incremental improvements on the basic concept. So, you know, the original one might have said, well, you can have two or three blades, and then somebody came along and said, I'm going to put four. And then the next guy said, well, I'm only going to have two, but I'm going to have diamond-tipped blades. Or I'm going to have two, anything between two and four, but I'm going to put a moisturizing strip. So, you know, you protect all of these different little improvements on. There are very few. Look, human ingenuity is infinite, right?
Mm.
There will always be some wombat somewhere that's improving something.
Yeah.
Okay? And that's what the patent system is designed for, is to actually accommodate those improvements. They come along. But the cornerstone patents, the real seminal patents, they are few and far between.
Mm.
Right now, most patents are just incremental improvements. But enough to have a technical advantage and enough to be novel over the original concept, but now they're just protecting a thin layer of technical advantage over an already known concept.
Very, very interesting stuff. But minefield, if you're not going to, you know, take it seriously, if you come up with a great idea, as you say, these things start between your ears. And
that's right.
You want to protect that. Tree says, thanks, John. Very, very clear. So there we go.
Awesome.
So is that it for today?
That's everything from my side for today, yeah.
Wonderful. And next time we're going to be speaking about?
Trademarks. I will have one of our associates in. She's a lot easier on the eye than I am, you'll be pleased to know. So her name is Merline, and I look very much forward to introducing her to you and to our listeners.
All right. Thank you very much, John, for coming in this afternoon. And folks, if you missed this or you're listening to it and you think that you know somebody who might benefit from the information shared this afternoon, it will be on a podcast later on this evening.
The IP Zone was brought to you by Spoor & Fisher because every pioneer needs a partner. Visit spoor.com.
You are a leader, a visionary. You embrace technology to develop cutting-edge solutions. You are original and innovative. You imagine. Trailblazing is often a lonely path, but we see the extraordinary in what you do. when it comes to understanding and protecting your intellectual property, your journey is our journey. Visit our website at spur.com and discover how we can protect what is uniquely yours. Spur & Fisher. Create it. Own it.